Well, Malcolm Holine is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning. Mr. Holine, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Good morning.
We've discussed this before, but I think it's worth repeating, and I know when it comes to good news, you always think it's worth heading back and reiterating stories like this. How did it feel this week when you got another call, I would suspect, that an item from the era of the Second Temple period had been found?
Look, every one of these discoveries, coming as they do at this sensitive time, reinforces the claim, the history, the reality, in the face of all the delegitimizers, all of those who seek to deny the Jewish connection to the Holy Land, to Israel. We see repeatedly now the calls from the Palestinian leadership, from others, seeking to deny any historical connection. And each of these discoveries is a tangible expression. I mean, it is the reality. It is, I think, Kadosh Baruch Hu is sending signals, but it's also a signal to us, to remind us of our past, to remind us of our responsibilities to protect these things, and realize that each of these discoveries is just another step. And there's so much more yet to be found. The finding of intact cooking pots and small ceramic oil lamps from the time of the Bayis Sheni, from the Second Temple. And they were in a drainage temple that was exposed from the Shiloah Pool to the City of David, to the beginning of Robinson's Arch, which everybody's heard about recently. And it's really remarkable, because they say it connects to the famine that occurred during the Roman siege of Jerusalem.
And if you want to Google it, folks, check it out. It's a cistern from the Second Temple period, and it's the one that was discovered this week. And it is so important to reiterate this, because sometimes we lose focus about what time in history we have the privilege of living in, and this is certainly one of the good ones as our history goes. Malcolm, the foreign ministry strike is driving a lot of people nuts. You know that Israeli consular services have been suspended. This is obviously a very important time of year for Aliyah, for paperwork, for a lot of stuff that needs to be done. Have you heard anything regarding the foreign ministry strike?
Well, I have, and I have expressed myself on it, because I think that this is really outrageous on a number of counts. One, the fact that even consular services now are suspended, meaning that people going on the Aliyah, people who need visas to visit Israel, that foreign leaders have had to cancel their visits because they're not getting the services of the members of the Foreign Service to facilitate the visits. There was a Hungarian official this week. There were many others over the last couple of in the months that this strike has been ongoing. And the very fact that you can have a strike for such a long period, and people in Israel not only don't care but are cynical or skeptical about it, is troubling. The people in the Foreign Service are, by and large, people who sacrifice themselves. When they go abroad, their wives can't continue their work. Many of them lose their pensions or the continuity of their employment. There have been scores that have been killed in representing Israel abroad. Many of them are very talented. They get paid very low wages. And I think the cynicism about it is very unfortunate. And there should be some effort to reconcile these differences, to regard the foreign ministry as we would our own foreign service, with the appropriate respect. And at the same time, they have to be realistic in the demands given the budget cuts. But the fact that things could deteriorate to this point, I think, is very regrettable.
Because as long as it's gone on, it's only the last few days, right, that everything's been suspended, so to speak?
Well, gradually they suspended various
services.
We were at meetings where the foreign ministry would normally be present, and they don't come. I had meetings at the foreign ministry, and people there came in dressed casually. They were under instructions, and the union guides them on all of these things and sets pretty tough restrictions, which, while observed in the breach, I mean, people did still, members of the foreign ministry still, you know, did work and did come to work and were in touch with us and with others. This escalation, this is the latest step, ends the consular services, which were continuing despite the strike.
And no end in sight, right? Like, you wouldn't know if it's a day or a month or what, right?
Right now, nobody seems to care about it.
The Prime Minister of Israel, a statement was attributed to him this week. I don't think it was a quote, but I think it was a report that he said he would release more terrorists. Now, this is in an effort to secure the release of certain Israelis, or for what reason would he consider releasing more terrorists? Or more those who've been incarcerated for terrorism?
No, this is part of, this was supposedly going to be part of the deal with getting Abbas to the table, but he has said that he will not release. Abbas is demanding the release of prisoners again, and what Netanyahu, that I know, said was, I know what's going to happen. He'll pocket this, he'll come to the talks, and a week later he'll break away and then make a demand for another release, constantly seeking to up the ante for, for negotiations.
Just trying to see what day I wrote it down. Unfortunately, I don't have the story.
But it changes every day.
Could it be that it seems like I'm asking you this question more and more each time. Could it be that I saw a report that said maybe that Netanyahu was considering or was weighing?
There were reports about that, yes.
So he was weighing the possibility of releasing terrorists. Is this all because of the Kerry pressure? And I think this is unique, and I've pointed this out before, but I don't think we've seen it as acute as it is now. And you'll tell me if I'm right or wrong. It seems that we've never been further apart in peaceful times for negotiation. I'm not talking about ceasefires that have to be negotiated, etc. And yet, the shuttle diplomacy would make you think that they're near a deal. That's how often he's there, and that's how much he continues to keep the PA and Israel in the headlines regarding peace.
That's a good point, because it's something that's created by the frequency. His fifth visit in less than half a year.
Right,
but. It's not a lot of this is momentum and not action in terms of result or any kind of concrete results. I think it's important, they feel it's important to keep the momentum alive, not to let this die, because then everybody sinks into even harder line positions, or it becomes exploited, and you don't want to give anybody the excuse. Clearly now Kerry seems to be saying that Abbas is the obstacle. Netanyahu continues to say he's ready to come without condition. And Abbas's latest trick is to say that he's ready to sit down with Netanyahu, with Kerry, for talks, about the talks.
Right.
So he's not really dropping the preconditions, which he's demanding, which are about the 67 borders commitment, prisoner release, etc. What he's saying is, I will sit down with talks so that he won't take the blame. But he said, but then he'll set the conditions for the talks.
Right. We never saw Hillary travel in half a year this often, unless we just didn't notice, right?
Well, she also went to different areas. This is his primary area of responsibility.
And that's because of the president, or he made it his thing?
Now, I would think that but both are true, that he's always had an interest in the Middle East. He's always made this a key area of his involvement. But I think that the president sort of gave this area to him to play with, and that other places like China, et cetera, are remaining in the White House's purview. And remember, it's been complicated because you had the prime minister again resign, the new prime minister, when we spoke last week.
He had just handed in his
resignation, then he rescinded it, and then he's back, he's resigned, and you see they don't have so quickly anybody to replace him. They're also saying, that meetings, that they don't want Jews in meetings, even with reporters. So the true nature of what the positions that they're advocating become more and more clear if anybody who really wants to see it. And then at the same time, you have his situation in Gaza heating up, which puts pressure on them as well. It's not directly, it's not in their control. But when Hamas kills the leading Islamic Jihad rocket chief, and then they respond, and in fact, the rockets that were fired on Israel was really Islamic Jihad versus Hamas, not so much versus Israel. Israel responded, but it was really an internal battle, and Egypt is working to close more tunnels, and somewhat successfully, actually, and the price of cement, for instance, as a result, has gone from $95 to $217.
1 second. So when you fire rockets and you don't intend to hit Israelis, is that considered a breach of the ceasefire or not?
It's a breach no matter what, right?
I mean, when you're aiming at somebody else.
Yeah, but I didn't mean you. I really meant
right, exactly. So what do we call that? That would have to be a
Talmudic. That's a Jackie Mason moment.
Right, a Talmudic discussion about whether the ceasefire has in fact been broken. Because I did see those words, befeirish, as they say, in media sources, that it was a break in the ceasefire.
Yeah, it's obviously a break in the ceasefire, right. But sometimes, you know, it can be, they say, you know, just, the Israelis are incidental to most things these days.
And you can say that again. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program. Heard and listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, around the world on the web at jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein with us, weekly update, and speaking of the Holy Land, I'm told that Rabbi Yudin will speak to us from the Holy Land after this segment coming up regarding the Torah portion. Malcolm, one of these things where people like when I put certain things on the agenda and I felt that I should follow up and do so. So the Supreme Court makes a decision regarding the Defense of Marriage Act. Our tradition, obviously, is... most closely, or certainly the more traditional end of our tradition, is most closely associated being against the way the Supreme Court ruled this week. Do you fear that as a behavior that traditional Judaism does not accept becomes more acceptable and more the norm, so to speak, and we become more the aberration? That's a fact. I'm not giving an editorial here. Do you fear that it could be difficult for the Jewish community to continue to be taken seriously in this context, in this country?
Look, I think that as long as they don't, there's no attempt to infringe on the rights of those who do not agree, although many people feel that when moral values, and it's not just Jews, that they hold are jeopardized or seen as I forgot Moynihan's exact term, but you know, dumbing down of values, etc., as right. Some people put it. So, I mean, it is I know a matter of great concern, and many people have raised the issues involved in a variety of the matters that have been that are being discussed, and have some of which have been subjects of Supreme Court rulings, but. It's the impact on society as a whole, I think, that people are focusing on. It's not that it infringes on rights. When it comes to particular institutions, though, certain hospitals and others have raised issues that it impinges on their moral values when they're demanded to do certain actions.
Right, but when you don't believe in something or you believe otherwise, it seems, especially with media pressure these days, that people start to look at you as haters, as intolerant, and you know, who wants labels like that on them?
Well, especially, it's important about how people give expression, and it's one of the reasons why I express concern about the nature of the exchanges and the rhetoric in Israel at times on sensitive issues and political issues, and even between political leaders, because you know it creates a public impression, and the isolation can often be self-imposed.
Yeah, that's true. Depending on how one acts, and I'm not referring to, in reference to the way they act and expressing their point of view. You were in Israel last week, as we know, and there are so many people, especially in the observant end of the, or I shouldn't say it that way. There are so many people, especially in the end of the community, that's always focused on Israel, that are so concerned about this chief rabbi battle. And we know that every day, more candidates, more rhetoric, and we discussed a lot of it last week, you may recall. In Israel, is it causing that type of aggravation? In other words, are these battles that are being fought in the media ripping apart the country, as some of us sometimes feel ripped apart when we read about it?
Yes, absolutely. It's very serious. I was present at a wedding of the Rav of the Kotel, and Rav Stav was there, and on the way out, I saw that he was harassed by young people and others, and it's a subject of discussion everywhere, and because there have been overlays of accusations against certain individuals over the past few days of people involved in the rabbinate, and that the race absolutely has a much broader ripple effect, and it tends to undermine further the confidence in the position, and for those who are, let's say, less connected and who are skeptical anyway, it adds to that skepticism and the feeling that this is maybe it's unnecessary. There are people calling for the dissolution of the chief rabbin, and people calling for reform of it. So on all sides, I think it's negative, and it also pits groups against one another, and they destroy people in the process.
And I assume this will go on at least for another month till the election takes place.
It could go on for a long time.
By the way, do you know who officially elects, like what committee and how and procedure or...
I do, but I don't want to get into it because I don't understand it.
Right, it's a very difficult committee.
It's complicated because there's a council of the rabbinate with people appointed, and it's complicated.
And speaking of battles, and I'm sure you've been involved in this one more than once. So we read again about the EU and products from Judea and Samaria. They want that on the label, right? They think it's consumer friendly to let people know that certain items that have been manufactured come from Yehuda and Shomron. Correct?
That's exactly what they're saying, is that this is not a boycott as it's been charged, but in fact just letting the consumer know that they know the origin. They don't bother with Catalonia to do it. They don't bother in all the other disputed areas to make sure that it says exactly what the geographic origin is. And clearly, it's meant to be discriminatory. What they don't realize is that it's much more discriminatory against Palestinians, because they're the ones who are employed and who will lose jobs, and that the Israelis, the Jews, can move the factories across the Green Line, and that... very often, that punishing their own people. You know, you see SodaStream goes over $1 billion valuation,
right,
despite being the subject of a lot of controversy. So it is not to be dismissed. This is a trend. We see that in Germany, people introduced such legislation. In France, in the last 2 days, and I'm meeting today with the Minister of Interior there to address this issue. It is part of the delegitimization campaign, of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. I've talked about it for a long time. It's here as well. There are people who are pressing for those kind of measures here. Thank God it's not yet caught on, but we should not dismiss it. And you know that in Europe there's a survey that shows that half of the Jews in Belgium, France, and Hungary are now considering emigration from those countries.
Wow.
And from other countries as well. So it adds to the climate. It becomes part of the, you know, anti-Israel, qua anti-Jewish efforts.
Yeah, no question about it. And if we had time, you can go into the whole history. I'm sure you've been battling this for years and years. All right, we got to do Syria and Egypt, but I got to just humor me for a minute. We know that we have somewhat differing opinions on Snowden, but I just got to ask you, wasn't it obvious to the President of the United States that if he would start a public battle with Putin, he would likely lose, that Putin probably would not back down to U.S. demands for extradition?
The U.S. was very careful in the way they phrased it, and they're approaching it knowing that they had very little leverage, and Putin could argue that he never really was in Russian territory because he was only in the airport, which is international territory, et cetera, et cetera. He was never going to give in on this demand. We don't know what information was transferred to Moscow from Snowden. This is a huge embarrassment. It's a story that's not going away, and the fact that he will find safe haven in Ecuador or someplace else, and will be able to continue to provide the information. He has on 4 computers that he's carrying around with him. So it is definitely a matter of concern. If I can go back just one second,
sir,
because it's an issue that I know a lot of people have followed with us, the Al-Dura case, Mohammed Al-Dura, and the case against the French television,
right,
the report that came out in Israel that we reported on 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, that there was no Mohammed Al-Dura. I mean, if there was no killing, no evidence that Israel was responsible, etc.
Right.
The French courts came out against Philip Karsetny, who had charged the French television with defamation for accusing Israel, and they ruled against him. This is on appeal, and it's a very sad decision, because clearly he was right, and whether the language was exactly the right language to use or not is irrelevant. It's the message that this sends. It does not in any way undermine the fact that the results of all the tests and everybody's examination is that Israel did not kill this guy.
So it may have been a semantics issue that...
Well, it is, because he used the term. If he hadn't accused him of defamation, he actually won the factual...
Right. Suit. We've seen that before. There's precedent of that.
There's always precedent.
Yeah, that's true. And back to Snowden for a second. So he'll definitely find a country for safe haven. I mean, he's not... He will not be hunted down and assassinated. Or we don't know.
Well, the U.S. said they won't scramble jets.
Right.
To get
but you don't necessarily need jets.
Ecuador is willing to sacrifice a very lucrative financial arrangement, you know, special privileges with the U.S. and business trade. So, clearly, they're continuing.
I mean, don't... You have to. You have to, as somebody who is enveloped in Jewish existence for all these decades, you have to have some level of fear or paranoia about what he has revealed, about what our national government has done to know as many details as possible about every citizen.
Even
it's got to
be chased.
I know, but it's got to scare you. I mean, what does it, I hate to ask you what it reminds you of in terms of...
I know exactly what you mean, and look, we hope the United States has more restrictions, but unfortunately what we've seen with the IRS, with other things, raises a lot of concerns on the part of people. I hear it from them. I share it. We don't know how much of what we say and what we do is monitored or can be used. I hope that it's restricted and that there are governors and controls, but you know, certainly doesn't appear that way by the initial revelations.
Did you read the cover of the cover story of the New York Times magazine on Sunday?
No.
All right. Get to it. Get to it when you have a chance.
Okay.
Because you can even find it online, because it will frighten you about what everyone knows about everything, especially those who are in Washington right now. They took it to a new level during this election campaign. They took it to the most recent one. They took it to a brand new level. Are there UN peacekeepers in the Golan or not?
Yes, there are. UNDA forces, and they have been renewed, actually, but the biggest contingent, the Austrians, have been removed. The Russians have offered to send troops. Israel's always sensitive about which countries send troops there, but the truth is that they've been largely completely ineffectual. Their presence is important, their activities much less so. They did not stop the importation of tens of thousands of missiles to Hezbollah, in violation of what their commitments were. So they're there. Hopefully they'll continue to be there, and even more so that they will really do a job.
And as the Syrian death toll continues to escalate into the six figures, it seems that it doesn't stir anybody to intervene to any greater degree than they have till this point.
Well, nobody knows exactly how to intervene at this point. We see that Saudi Arabia is sending anti-aircraft missiles. Sorry. And the United States has said they're training and vetting fighters to use the new weapons they're sending in. I don't think that there's a shortage of weapons. I think that there's been a warehouse created of weapons, like in Libya, as I said in recent weeks. The Russians have just put the most advanced intelligence ship on the coast, and came to Syria through the Dardanelles from through Turkey. I think each of these things are an escalation. The Russians have said they've taken out their military, but if you read more carefully, they said that's except for those technicians and people training Syrians in the use of Russian weapons. Well, that's a good cover for a lot of people. What we're also seeing, as I said before, was the fact that this is increasingly a Sunni-Shiite clash,
right,
over history, over religion, over everything. Hezbollah has acknowledged losing 500 people, or believed to have lost 500 people in Syria. They don't bring back the bodies because they don't want people to see it, but they do it slowly. You have more than 100 opposition groups. So when you say about what you can do, the opposition groups are fighting each other. And even some of the refugees, in fact, thousands if not more, have returned now to fight. At the same time, you have the influx of foreign fighters, and you see the Europeans expressing more and more concern about this issue that we discussed already many weeks ago, but they're always late in trying to address these issues. But the internal divisions, we see Iran more active in Yemen, we see the situation in Yemen deteriorating, certainly Egypt with this weekend, we'll come to that. But it's the situation in Syria could sustain for a long time if you don't have big foreign intervention. The question is how much pressure will be brought to bear to get you know, a no-fly zone or other steps, but the standoff is likely to be there for a while.
All right. Why is Morsi going through all of this weekend, and why has this time been chosen to hit the streets and express their disappointment in him?
Well, the demonstration's on the 30th, because that's the one-year anniversary of his accession to power. There's tremendous resentment against him, and the threat of the military saying that they'll come back in to restore peace. And remember that they have a big vested interest having 30% of the economy under their control. There are many questions about Morsi's losing support, even amongst the Muslim Brotherhood, some of whom want a Salafist, some of them who are just unhappy. There are 1.5 million people have already signed a petition for him to resign, and their economy continues to spiral down. They're going to exhaust their fuel supplies by the end of the month, and this is going to raise the price of fuel there again. The situation in Sinai continues to be of great concern. There's still a high alert there. They've clamped down on the tunnels more. They've done some stuff because it's hurting their economy, and because the smuggling, as we talked about before, is impacting them. So the situation is a total collapse of the economy, the political unrest, the inability of the Muslim Brotherhood to fulfill their promises. They have no experience. They were thrust in positions that he didn't initially want. They didn't want to be the president first, if you remember.
Right. And we asked this question a year ago and probably 2 years ago, and a lot of times in between. Instability in Egypt, it's automatically trouble for Israel?
It's always dangerous for Israel, because whoever is in control, at least the military and security, are cooperating with Israel vis-a-vis Gaza and the Sinai. You could get somebody even more hardline come in, and the total collapse there only feeds the instability and extremism in the region that is so prevalent.
So can an objective observer say that Morsi has essentially kept the same type of relationship as his predecessors with Israel?
No.
At this point,
his rhetoric is different. We know what his true beliefs are. I mean, Mubarak kept a cold peace. I think it's much colder now under the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, doesn't stay in one place. They're trying to operate into other areas, and their rhetoric, their fundamental beliefs, we know, are obviously very hostile to Israel, and some of the statements that leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood make on the ground, in practical terms, vis-a-vis, again, those two troubling situations, there is more cooperation, and the military in Israel did tell me that, in fact, that they were not unhappy with the nature of the relationship.
Finally, you were in Israel last week. What did they tell you about a replacement for Stanley Fischer?
It's going to be Jacob Frankel, who was actually an old friend of ours and was the head of the bank from, I think, in the 90s until the year 2000. He's subsequently was head of AIG and chairman of J.P. Morgan International. He's a very respected figure, and so that he will assume the position sometime, I think, in the fall.
All right, next week.
And the other position that's the hottest debate is who will be the next ambassador. It looks like Ron Dermer is again emerging as a primary candidate.
Yeah, I think Mariv announced it already this morning, less than maybe, with my knowledge of Hebrew, it may have been just that he was the primary candidate.
I would say it's more likely he's the primary candidate.
And is he a good guy?
He's very capable. He's smart. He was born in Miami. He speaks English perfectly. He's been the closest to the prime minister, so he knows the issues and every reason to expect that he would be. He had some tensions with the administration, but they worked it out, I think, during the president's visit to Israel. At least that's what the papers reported. So right. I think it could be that that will be announced. I think Ambassador Oren is leaving in September, according to the agreement he reached 2 weeks ago.
So from a Jersey boy, we go to a Floridian.
Right. So you see the importance of Aliyah. You want to be an ambassador, go on Aliyah, and they said you're back.
That's amazing. You get the best of both worlds, huh?
Yes, I hope.
All right, Malcolm, even though next week is what everyone seems to consider the 4th of July weekend, I am here, so hopefully we will speak next week.
God willing.
Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Holine is Executive Vice Chairman, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on Friday mornings at JM in the AM. When I said Mariv, I meant Yediot. I should get the newspaper name straight first, then I can start considering talking about what they're actually reporting.